welcome to the Making Impact series, where we talk to life science thought leaders on how they are making impact with their work and all they do. I am your host, Helen Konozopoulos, the co-founder of Odea.ai and also an adjunct professor at the Department of Computer Science at the University of Toronto. Today, I really want to welcome an amazing story, an amazing founder who's working on some very cool technology, and I think will really change our thinking today. So I'd like to welcome Viraj Mane from Lectiga.
Welcome. Helen, great to be with you once again.
So I want to hear about your origin story, and then I also then talk about Lectiga and where you're at and how it came about. So give me a little bit of background on who you are.
Terrific. Yeah, thanks for today's opportunity. So excited. And our origin story, I really love it. I'm a science nerd in terms of my earlier life, but this company's origin story really has almost nothing to do with that. The story was really becoming a dad, and that happened about 9 years ago. So I have a very, very active young daughter. And when she was still a baby and was still breastfeeding, and this is fairly common for moms that are at work, pumping at work or pumping late at night, they start to accumulate extra pouches of breast milk or human milk. And they go in the freezer, because if you don't need them that day, you keep them so you can use them some other time. Now, in our house, those pouches actually started stacking up in the freezer. Less room for ice cream and alcohol, because now you have milk pouches. So, and I used to joke with my other buddies because they had become parents around the same time. But that got me thinking from a scientific perspective, if there's this extra in the world, and we're not the only ones, other families have extras, like, is there enough extra to do something with medically? And that got me learning about milk banks, which are a network of over 700 organizations all around the world, almost all of them nonprofits. And their job and their mandate is to actually secure these extra samples from moms who very generously donate the amount they don't need, meaning they have enough to breastfeed their own child exclusively for as long as they can, but they produce so much extra, they're willing to give it to milk banks. Milk banks then process that and pool it and make it available as a genuine milk product, a nutritional food for medically fragile babies. And premature babies are the example that many people have heard of, where they're so tiny they can't even feed and they're too weak. And so that's the mandate of milk banks. So because we knew that they were a centralized network of organizations that understood how to process milk and treat it and build connections with mothers and also provide that to infants in need, we said, let's get a sense from milk banks. Like, if we had an idea to repurpose the unused supply and focus on antibody therapeutics, which we'll get into, is that something they would support? Would they consider that a conflict? Would they say, no way, we want nothing to do with you? And so to get that answer, we started literally cold calling executive directors of milk banks, a few in Canada, a few in the US, one in the UK. And this was when we had, I think, no data or maybe small amounts of data. So we had very little to tell in terms of traction or company formation. It was really just a vision. And we had learned by that point that there are people with antibody deficiencies, specifically in the airways and the gastrointestinal tract. If you don't have antibody protection, just as you'd expect, you get infected by various pathogens way more often than healthy people. And those can be viral, bacterial, fungal, and parasitic. Now, for specific patients with antibody deficiencies and those who are missing IgA antibodies, that happens to be the same antibody that is naturally abundant in human milk. So we felt like that was a pretty perfect fit. You take patients who are missing IgA antibodies, and then you provide IgA antibodies, which are sourced from these milk samples. So that was the vision. And it allowed us to tell this potential medical narrative about milk banks being this really critical partner in taking something that they currently flag as trash, because it doesn't meet their inclusion criteria for medically fragile babies, but to say, we can make use of that. We can use our extraction technologies, derive the antibodies that we're interested in, and position those pooled polyclonal antibodies as a therapeutic for those immunodeficient patients. And that was a vision that they could get behind. And I'm happy to say that led to really fantastic relationships with some of these milk bank directors. Beyond relationships, they provided signed letters of support. We've actually built some of the first ever contracts with a for-profit biotech venture engaging with nonprofit milk bank suppliers as supply partners. So that's a quick snapshot of being a dad to launching a company.
Wow. So, when I proposed our you know, our series, and I said, look, this is a founder that's pretty cool. And I think it came from Y Space, so it came from York University's connection. And I remember reading and going, okay, you know, like, where am I seeing the connection between women's breast milk and therapeutics, which I totally understand it. Like, I get it, but for little babies, right? Or for, you know, that environment, but extending it to other therapies and supporting other people who need it. That was very cool. That was a very kind of, for me, it was a spatial jump. Like, I did not see that. But I think that comes to you not only being a dad, but I think it's also your background to be able to understand this. And I think this is something that I'd like you to explain, is that you were able to see an opportunity because your background, your where you've been, your experiences, to kind of connect, you know, here's your wife and here's your baby, and then saying, look at all this stuff in my fridge. Can you tell me a little bit about that background? So how do you create those connections where you spark that idea and you go, wait a minute, I can do something with that?
Yeah, what a great question, and so key for anyone in the founder ecosystem. Literally the last couple of calls I've had, I've kind of touched on this same point, which is, to me, you have to recognize the role of serendipity and some of the things you didn't plan out in your life and how they come full circle. And so my version of that is, did my PhD in molecular and human genetics, worked on several rare diseases. And this was back at Baylor College of Medicine, amazing graduate program in Houston. From there, did two postdocs, one at the US FDA, one at the University of Maryland, covering virology, immunology, biochemistry, nanotechnology. At that time, I assumed I'd be, you know, the assistant professor and become a tenured professor and follow that fairly traditional academic career pathway. All of that appealed to me. However, I had really good opportunities to come away from the lab and explore skill sets that were really not about techniques in a laboratory, you know, business development, technology development, portfolio strategy, support, and playing a consulting role for the U.S. Department of Defense, for example, where they were building a medical countermeasures portfolio. And providing some strategic guidance that, you know, which technologies would support the right stakeholders against very specific pathogens. So really taking much higher level views on, you know, what's the best way to deploy a $100 million budget? You know, which programs should get this $1 million grant? I mean, that's a very different way of thinking than performing procedures in a laboratory. So I was very grateful to have those different experiences. And you're exactly right. I mean, I sort of left that out on purpose in the origin story, is that I'm looking at milk as a new dad. But I'm also looking at it as a scientist who's actually studied immunology, virology, infectious diseases, pandemic preparedness for years prior to becoming a parent. And those background experiences absolutely are the reason that I could see a spark of an idea when I was looking at those milk pouches. No question.
Yeah, this, when we were, you know, prepping for this call, and it was like, sometimes that's when you connect your background, like taking my notes now. And sometimes people always ask me, and especially students and my students, and I got a question yesterday saying, how do I find patterns? You know, how am I supposed to look at patterns to say, how do I pattern recognition opportunities? And I think it comes with practice, but it also comes with that opportunity because you're a scientist, because you've done work like this. And also you have that mixture of science and business. So it's not just an academic, you know, academic thinking or scientific thinking, but you're thinking, can you go to market with something like this? So I think that was very, very interesting. I kind of want to think about the mothers in this, the user, well, not the user, but the donator. When you were talking with milk banks, and you were discussing with them, you know, how do donations happen? How is education happening for the mother? Do you need to be part of that more? Because now it's not only going to little children, little babies, it's going further than that. Is there further education you have to be part of that?
Yeah, what a great question. And really the preface to that is, we recognize, and by we, I mean myself and my founder, Rikin Mehta, who's also an Indian American male, same as myself. So we're not exactly, you know, deep in the world of the mother's experience, right? So we recognize we would have to be extremely thoughtful, sensitive, be careful, respectful to talk to milk banks firstly, as well as any other stakeholders. And that includes, you know, mothers to be, lactation consultants, doulas, because midwives, these are people that actually understand this vision. And I'll take a quick note about midwives before we come back to your question, because this is just such another great example of serendipity. I was actually at the J-Labs event center in the Mars Tower. And I was there for sort of just a networking thing, hors d'oeuvres, you know, fancy cocktails, so having a good time. And just that particular evening, it happened to be a really large contingent of women from a midwifery conference, so for midwives, which happened to be at the Women's College just down the street. And their after-event reception was also at J-Labs, just to, you know, consolidate different people. So I just overheard people saying, this room is full of midwives who just finished a conference. I think this was back in 2017. And this whole idea for the company Lactiga was just a thought in my brain, nothing more than that. But since they were there, I said, well, let me ask you this question. It's just something I've been thinking of. If the, you know, the extra milk that couldn't be used by milk banks could be applied to this other purpose, and it could work for, you know, children and adults, you know, non-breastfeeding infants, what would you think about that? Would that seem like a bad idea to mothers? And almost all of them, within 2 minutes of describing this vision, said, no, that would make perfect sense. I would tell my clients, my moms, to get involved in that, because that the immunology makes sense, the biology makes sense. So that was another piece of serendipity, just like asking this very bizarre question to people I'd never met and getting amazing feedback. And then coming back to your question, like, you know, how do we create a system of trust that the mothers and the milk banks actually want to be part of that system? You know, we really had to write our own playbook for, you know, is this a business development exercise? Because it's not B2B. I mean, it's like a for-profit, you know, growing company that has almost no traction in those days, speaking to nonprofit milk banks. We also knew, and we came to learn more from our discussions with them, that they have occasionally been approached by for-profit companies, especially in the infant formula space. And, you know, today we can probably touch on the infant formula recalls and the shortage issues that have literally just happened these last couple of days and weeks. But we learned from them that this supply is obviously very precious, but there is this overage. There are samples that are flagged as not usable based on the inclusion criteria standards set by the milk banks, and those are set obviously for the safety of the babies who would be the recipients. So some of the flags that can exclude a sample are being too old, having a higher than threshold bacterial count, or if they simply came from mothers who are taking even simple prescription medications, as prevalent and common as antidepressants and blood pressure medications, which are actually fairly common in the general population, including the lactating mother population. So the milk banks tended to exclude samples for that variety of reasons, just to ensure maximum safety for the medically fragile babies that will consume it. But we were able to say from our perspective, it's not going to matter if the bacterial count was higher at the front end, or there was antidepressants at the front end, because we're going to perform extractions, we're going to wind up with the polyclonal antibodies we're interested in. So we were able to pitch that as, like, you know, a technological workaround, so that samples that were flagged as a no for them could be a yes for us. Larger than that, we also had to determine a playbook and really some collateral that we could share the vision with these milk bank directors. So we started with one pagers, two pagers. We actually wound up building up something closer to, you know, an 8 or 10 page proposal summary to say, this is the company's vision. The early results are very limited, but very promising. Again, this was years ago. And this is the vision by which we believe we can engage with milk banks to launch what we hope will be transformative therapeutics for highly vulnerable people of all ages, not just infants. And this is the way that a for-profit company could partner with nonprofit milk banks. And if we can structure a compensation framework that feels fair to them and equitable to them, then we can construct a supply relationship. I mean, all pharmaceutical companies have to purchase supply, whether it's, you know, bulk leaves from Asian countries for tea extracts, or the raw chemicals for traditional small molecule pharmaceuticals. Everyone has a supplier. That's, you can't get around that. So our relationship on the supply side was this, to try to work directly with milk bank directors, but being way more careful, because this isn't a traditional purchase of a bulk compound. This is a naturally occurring human starting material. And so we had to be a lot more thoughtful and careful about how that would look to our potential partners. And I'm happy to say that by being careful and respectful, we were successful in that.
Yeah, I think it's the, you know, it's those little relationships or those bumping into, right? That's how we started, right? It was, again, the same thing. We're in Mars, bump into someone who is in research development at U of D and said, you know, Helen, like, wow, that's what you're working on. Let me do an introduction, right? So it's those, and that's how we got into the pharmaceutical industry, right? And I think it's those relationships, but it's also kind of being prepared. It's being prepared to say, if you bump in, so the luck is for, you know, I call it luck is for the prepared, right? That saying is when you are prepared to have those conversations and ask the right questions. So all the work you did previously has like led, was able to have those conversations in an educated way. Otherwise you're like, the conversation could have gone really wrong, especially with midwives who are really protecting the mother and child, right? So they are there as the barrier and the one who's going to say, like, I am their advocate. I am the one who's going to support them. So that click, that is really inspiring. And I love when I hear kind of accidental, but not accidental. Like, you're in J Labs, right? It's a great location. I've been there many times. I've, I've done lots of presentations there, and it's fantastic. It's looks over Queen's Park. It's amazing. So I think it's amazing that you're saying this. And I think just a comment to all the listeners, you never know when you're going to bump into the person who's going to help you like move a project forward. So this is great to hear.
This is a great sort of relationship building philosophy, which I think, you know, business school grads, maybe this is obvious for them, but it's much less obvious for those of us that come in, you know, straight through the hard sciences, which is, you know, if you're meeting someone that might have something valuable to you, you have to be willing to ask for that, right? If there's something you want, you have to be willing to articulate that. But even better if you can make it clear that you think there's something in it for them, or like you'd like to pay it back or pay it forward in some way. I mean, really, in all our early discussions, the milk bank discussions being a perfect example, you know, we really had to say, like, if you gave us this precious thing, this is what we think we could do. And this is what would it mean for needy people or vulnerable people around the world. And, you know, so that way you show your stakeholders that they should take some part in that upside. If this becomes a new therapy in the world, a lot of that credit can go to them. And I don't just mean financially. I mean, you know, optically, emotionally, professionally. There's a lot of different upsides. And it's not easy to articulate that in a short introductory session, but I mean, that was the challenge. And that's so, like, if I had just talked about a couple scientific details, those conversations never would have landed. It's got to be about, what does this mean for you, for me, for people that actually need help? And then that's something people can get behind. They've never been asked to get behind it, but if you give them an opportunity, of course they want to help.
And it's the story. You had a whole story behind it, right? And I think that's what clicked in my mind. Because I think if you just read the science and you just, it would have just been sounding very science fiction-like, right? And I bet you get a lot of that. And there's a lot of weird, random science fiction movies out there that kind of have this kind of thing going on. But when you talk about it, saying this is already a normal practice, and now we're extending the therapy beyond that normal practice that is happening to help more people, then it's a good, the story makes sense, right? But I kind of want to, I want to kind of go into where you're at now. Where are you now as a company? Where, you know, you told us where you're coming from, your guiding partners, you're doing what you're working on, but where are you at this moment as a company?
Yeah, I think the helpful way to think about it is that hockey stick growth curve that all startups think about, like you just kind of trundle along and hopefully there's that inflection point. I think it's fair to say we're a little bit past that inflection point where like pretty big things keep happening week over week or month after month. So I'll give a quick rundown of you know, where we have been the last couple of months and how things have sort of turbocharged in these past couple of weeks. So as a company, we now have 3 issued patents. They're unencumbered. They belong to the company itself. So I'm proud of that part because we, you know, as founders, we self-funded very small, very lean studies in the early days just to be patent enabling. We knew this wasn't going to be a Nature paper, but that wasn't the point. The point is, can you get a stamp from an intellectual property perspective? And we were able to do that. Once we got closer to that, we realized we had to do the venture funding route. I mean, you know, smaller grants are great, They're so critical for helping young companies establish early proof points. But as you get to certain engagements, you're going to need $100,000 or you're going to need $300,000. So you got to start thinking about, like, how do we pitch this to the venture community? And so, you know, literally years of work on understanding how startup financing works, how much psychology, that FOMO, investor FOMO, that is absolutely a real thing. And this is another example of you have to be willing to step far away from the science. Like, if I just talked about antibody molecular structures and details like that, those conversations would have went nowhere. We know that for sure. It's got to be about the bigger picture story and then layering on what is the opportunity. And it's, you know, I'm never going to be happy that to create a medical invention, you have to convince people that you can make a ton of money, but that is the reality. So if you're willing to speak that language and you can do the research, and any scientist can research markets the way they research, you know, their own scientific domain, they are capable of doing this. I mean, I'm proof of that. I've really never taken a formal business class in my life, but these days online, there is an infinite amount of quality content, the business side, the financing side, like what do actual terms mean in an investor term sheet? It's just math. I mean, it feels intimidating in the beginning. That's never going to change. But once you just do the formulas, you realize, you know, I could do this with an Excel macro in a formula cell. I can understand the math. It's not rocket science.
Yeah. And I think it's the same question I had yesterday from a student saying, I'm a computer scientist. And I go, there's a lot of resources out there. And sometimes you don't have to go it alone. There are advisors, there are support systems. And also, you know, bringing in co-founders or first employees and bringing the people around you to support you on, you know, to help you. But the onus falls on you to do the work, to learn.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and
absolutely.
The curiosity you need. I was never in pharmaceuticals. So I took a lot of leaps and bounds and focus groups and talking to people and, you know, having worked on projects in the past with, you know, the Department of Computer Science and the Faculty of Medicine, I think that's what got me to this point. But that learning, those like the steep learning curve, you just do it. You just have to That's do right. as a founder. So any good news on your side when it comes to like Tiga?
Yeah. And actually, so I'll get to that. I'm going to come back to your previous question because I didn't really answer it much, which is where we are now. And that'll feed into this question. So I mentioned we really just had to start understanding the venture capital process. And so we did that. Back in 2020, we closed some of our earliest funds. You know, a lot has changed since then. And this is maybe more for the biotech audience, but I think this will have some traction for people outside of that as well, which is that in traditional pharmaceuticals and biotech, you know, you can test a new molecule and if it prevents a disease or it does something to cells, that's great. That's a great starting point. But that's such a small piece of the overall puzzle. And what I mean by that is for us, we have to think about not only can you extract it and our patents have, you know, provided the coverage and they've addressed the technologies that we developed, which says we can extract what we want from this starting material. But that has to be formulated. That has to be manufactured in a scalable way in a GMP compliant facility. It has to be delivered to patients. All the quality controls have to be built in. You have to have a regulatory package you can put in front of Health Canada or the FDA. So there's all of these other learnings. And so we've tried to be really thoughtful about moving the ball forward in these other domains, you know, manufacturing, formulations, regulatory strategy, rare disease, market opportunities, you know, opportunities for waived fees and large market incentives. There's all these other domains that are outside of the core technology, which is like biochemical extractions on a benchtop. You have to be willing to move all these other balls forward. I think that is what made the difference. And I think that's hopefully a takeaway for other founders. It doesn't just have to be in pharmaceuticals, is that there's going to be all these other verticals in your company that are really not about the core technology. You know, can you get more suppliers? Can you get more funding? Do you understand your customers? In our case, it would be patients. For many other companies, it would be customers. What are their actual behaviors? We really moved the ball forward in many of these other domains. A lot of it came from cold calls in the same way that Milk Bank director relationships started with cold calls and emails. On some of these other fields, it was the same thing on the manufacturing side. So, you know, to your question, where are we now? We actually have two parallel engagements on the manufacturing, meaning what are the scalable ways and the reproducible ways in which you can start with milk on one end, wind up with the antibodies on the other end, with everything in between documented in the way it needs to be for new drug filings. So that's the CTA in Health Canada, it's the IND and the FDA. So we've moved forward the manufacturing. We've grown that supplier base. On the investor side, we started with, you know, smaller offices, a lot of individuals, some friends and family who were not professional investors and could not write large checks, but wanted to be part of the early story. So very, very grateful for everyone that took those chances. But fast forwarding to now, our last major investor, they're called 1517 Fund. What is really exciting about this particular fund is that the principals all came from the Thiel Fellowship, started by Peter Thiel. And so literally their mandate and their focus is to only fund renegade scientists. And that's their words, not mine. Now, I love that because this is kind of a mad science approach. You know, like traditional pharma has not thought of going this route or they haven't put resources into it, but we have. And so it's this, you know, kind of crazy disruptive idea. And I think that's what resonated with this particular fund. You know, they said, you know, you can fund Harvard spinouts. That's probably a pretty safe bet. Or you could have this other investment thesis. And that's what 1517 Fund has. And we also closed another significant investment from an individual named Jude Gomila. He's a serial founder from the Silicon Valley ecosystem. He's currently a founder of a very large, very successful company. He made a substantial private investment as well. And both of these were examples of showing someone that, you know, this outsider's renegade approach or mad science approach to medical transformation, that makes sense. And, you know, to our earlier point, this was really about the story and the narrative. And not just about this is how much money we think we can make, but really this is how different it is than what's out there. And the patients can only take what's out there. They take a short list of approved medications. They have a lot of imperfections in those medications. They don't do everything that the patient would like. And so it's really, are you creating something that they would actually want to use and that they could use and that would make a difference? I think that is the part of the story that resonated most with these newer investors. So that's on the fundraising side. We met our seed fundraising target and then we exceeded it by a significant amount. So I'm very fortunate to say that we're now in that position. Then on the other side, I think it was yesterday morning, we got two emails from two different Canadian programs. One is the SOFI program, which supports innovations in Southern Ontario, funded by FedDev. So we received quite a substantial size grant from them, we found out yesterday. A couple hours later, yesterday, we found out that we also won a Can Export Innovation Award, so another source of federal funding. That's exciting because those are two commitments from, you know, the Canadian government to grow our operations in the country. And as I mentioned to you, Helen, on our last call, I've actually physically relocated to New Jersey in the U.S. To be closer to my partner, who's also in Jersey, to be closer to some of my childhood friends, so for both personal and professional reasons. But as we, you know, raise significant investments in the U.S. and grow our partnerships here, we still have this Canadian support to grow some of the relationships that we've wanted to build up anyway. So I'm really happy to have this bilateral, you know, parallel success story that's happening these last several weeks.
That's fantastic on the raises, fantastic on, you know, the pedigree of some of your VCs, and also the early, you know, your early champions. Just they are there for you for the long run because they really want to see success, not only for the company but for yourself, right? So they're there to like say, "Wow, this is amazing. This is growing. This is also going to make an impact." So I think this is amazing, and also, you know, having that government support to be able to launch and get more into the market is going to make a big impact. So that's fantastic. I have two more points, two more questions I wanted to ask. One is, and I think this might be our, you know, kind of side bloopers, kind of, you know, funny questions that you might've had. So what are the funniest or strangest comments you've had when you pitch or you've gone out there or you've been in the media? So you've been in the media before. What are some of the funny comments or questions you get?
That's a good question. One of them, it's not necessarily funny, but it's actually a good point, which is that, okay, like milk is great. Why not just like distribute milk to more people and not just breastfeeding infants, but to, you know, these adults that have these immunodeficiencies. The short answer to that is, while milk is this, you know, really nutritionally dense product for premature babies, the FDA, at least in the States, the FDA has actually recommended against sort of an informal sharing. Now, there are moms who actually create email lists or Facebook groups, and they do informally share to each other. And if it's for mothers that can't pump or you know, are not breastfeeding, it does fit this need, the specific gap that they have. But there's communities outside of breastfeeding that have an interest. And since you asked for like kind of funny ones, I'll share one. This is not a, it's not a community that we're really engaging, but it is an anecdote I heard about, which is that the male bodybuilder community has taken an interest. Not all of them, but there's sort of a, you know, there's different fringes. Some want to try different, you know, supplements or steroids, or everyone wants an edge. And so some of them identified that breast milk is obviously naturally occurring, so there's no synthetic chemicals. And because of the antibodies, it can ideally help keep you healthier. And so for that reason, some of them have gravitated towards that. And they've created this, you know, unfortunately, this kind of gray market or black market for them buying samples off moms that have extra and are willing to sell it for X amount of dollars per ounce. So not the community we're looking to serve, but it is an anecdote out there. And actually, I can't remember the name of the Netflix documentary, but it's, you know, it's kind of about like weird science and weird stories. And one of their episodes was about these bodybuilders who make those purchases.
Wow. That's like, okay, that's just weird. That's like something that, you know, that's.
And yes, it's, wow. You know, it's weird. And it's maybe not very scrupulous, because the quality controls for a grown adult to just drink a sample, like, are they testing? You know, do they know that the donation is clean and sterilized and not adulterated with, you know, cow milk or something else?
Think it's, you know, that's a whole, like, whole life that you just never thought was out there, like a whole that's part funny. Of the society you just never thought people did. So thanks for that. I'm going to be thinking about these bodybuilders and be like, okay, you know, just.
Well, I keep joking. We need to. I keep joking. We need to resurrect that got milk slogan from the 90s. Remember?
Yes.
The
milk mustaches? Yes. I remember that. Yeah.
I've been joking. That should be a company expense. We should buy that campaign and use it for us.
And I think it's like, just, you know, have some pea protein, you know, and just, you know, just. You're good to go, right? I think there's a lot of champions out there that don't need black market milk of some sorts, right?
And actually, but you know, knowing that, and like circling back, like, you know, if there's an odd encounter or anecdote that we don't really want to be involved in, but is there a learning there? You know, my philosophy is always like, just stay curious. Like, if you don't ever want to be part of that, is there something we should understand? And it's kind of, you know, the bioethics of any transfer of any human material, but especially breast milk, you got to be that much more sensitive and careful. And that's why we knew that, like, if we can't meet this threshold of like bioethical discussions, this is going to be a hard no from the milk bank directors giving us a no. So, it just reinforced, you have to be this much more careful.
Like, I think it's the trust factor, right? And it's the trust and the bioethics that come up, and to say, look, we're working with people's data. We're working, you know, of course, with, you know, human, you know, byproducts. Like, you know, it's very sensitive and very, you need to be trustworthy. And I think understanding that there's, you can't live in a silo in your industry. You've got to be very aware and be able to answer questions like this. And how do you protect things? Like, how do you protect information and items and, you know, like, how do you do this? And I think it's being ready to answer those types of questions. I think you already know this, like, that's why you're so successful. But I think it's for others to say, it's okay to be transparent. It's good to be transparent, to say, I understand that that's happening. And this is our reaction to it, you know, and I think this is really good. My last question then is, what is your vision in the next 10 years? Where do you want to be, and what kind of impact do you want to make?
Yeah, I've started thinking about this question a lot more, and I'll answer really the impact one. Cause I mean, you know, being very honest, for me personally, I mean, I don't have like, I want to have this much money or a boat. Like, I truly don't care about those kind of outcomes. What is so motivating and energizing, and you know, it makes me want to just like, you know, spend all my nights and weekends on this, is that my vision is, you know, X amount of years from now, let's call it 5 to 10 years, the patients we're talking about, which have primary immunodeficiencies, and in specifically these antibody deficiencies. So one of them is called selective IgA deficiency. The other is called common variable immune deficiency. they're in this bucket of rare disorders. So, you know, when you say rare, you kind of imagine that hardly anyone has it. But the reality is there's a few hundred thousand people in the U.S. that have, you know, severe forms of the selective IgA deficiency and common variable immune deficiency. So, you know, it's not a small amount of people, really. And the reality for them is they have, you know, a very short list of approved medications to protect them from the infections that they keep getting. And I don't just mean sniffles and a little bit of coughing. I mean severe enough infections that they're in and out of hospitals because of those infections. And the risk of nosocomial infections for patients like this is so much worse than the general population. So if they keep having to go back to hospitals to get more infusions and more treatments, okay, but they're probably also picking up nosocomial infections just from being in hospitals. So it's this horrible negative feedback cycle. You know, being in social settings, school, work, all of these things are risk factors for them much more than it is for the rest of us. And so one of the effective but very expensive and invasive medications out there is called intravenous immunoglobulin. It's actually serum-derived pooled antibodies. So while we're looking to start with milk and then pool milk antibodies and deliver them non-invasively with no needles or infusions, the current medication is pooled and then delivered by an infusion into the arm of the patient. That infusion can take about 6 to 8 hours per infusion. So you're sitting in a chair totally immobilized for that entire time. But that's going to happen minimum once a month for these patients for the rest of their lives. You know, it's not a 6-month thing, a 1-year thing. You can't ever stop because the moment you do, your susceptibility to infections once again increases to the point where you're likely to have hospitalizations for severe infections. So this is the reality for them. And when we talk about impact, my really only goal is for patients in these kind of situations, could their new reality be that they take non-invasive, easy-to-use products like inhalers to protect the respiratory tract or oral products to protect the gastrointestinal tract so that those infections are less likely to happen? But that if they happen, what if they're milder and easier to clear? If that becomes their new reality, that is really the only impact metric that I'm interested in. I mean, that would be a different daily quality of life. And this has been done in the past. Before IVIG, that was approved about 60 or 70 years ago. Prior to that, you know, diagnostics were very, very poor and inefficient for these patients. So at best, you might feel like you had the flu every day for your entire life, and you would probably die early. And that's, you know, kind of best case scenario long ago. And worst case scenario was you're just in and out of hospitals. They're using the strongest antibiotics and they still don't work. So you run out of options fast. That was the reality long ago. The development of IVIG did transform that reality quite a bit. Take a more contemporary example, the outcomes for HIV and AIDS patients today versus the late 80s. I mean, that's a night and day difference, right? The availability of therapeutics has actually transformed their outcomes and their quality of life. That's the type of transformation we're interested in. Nothing less than that.
It's amazing. I just, it's, you know, I keep on hearing you about the impact you're going to make by changing someone's lives. You know, we think it's rare, but no, rare means it's just not the general population, right? And it's, but there's a lot of the population, right? There's hundreds and thousands of people who go through these things and need that support and need these therapeutics. So amazing work. We're going to share with the audience all the links and all the information that, you know, to learn more about Lectiga. And I just want to thank you for coming onto the show. Thank you so much for taking your time today to talk about something very interesting and very educational. So thank you again, Viraj, for joining us.
Thank you, Helen. This is a wonderful opportunity.
Fantastic. Again, thank you so much for joining us today for the Making Impact series, where we talk to life science thought leaders on how they are making an impact in the work they do.